Hello everyone, Matt Phelan here. I am your host today for the Happiness in Humans podcast. For those that have never listened before, the Happiness in Humans podcast is a grouping of HR professionals, business leaders, researchers, scientists that are all united around how do we improve the world of work. And today I am delighted to speak to Jules. Hey Jules.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good morning. Good morning, Jules. I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself in your own words to our listeners.
Yeah, hi. That always feels like such a tricky thing. Like, which bit do I pick? Well, you know, as you said, you know, my name's Jules Eustance. And yeah, I mean, I suppose normally we lead into this stuff by saying, like, what we do. But that doesn't necessarily define us, does it? It's like, you know, we often, you know, you imagine in networking meetings, you go to those networking meetings and the first thing people say is, so what do you do? And I think, God, there's so much more that's of interest about people. So, you know, I suppose, you know, first and foremost, I'm a mom to two boys, a wife to my husband. And alongside all of that, I'm a professional. I'm a career. I've had a successful career in retail leadership and business change and transformation. And now I suppose the bit that's currently defining me is my current career choice, a career path, which is you know, and where we met and connected is around the point around, you know, how do we make work a better place. And you know, I suppose we'll get on to, you know, why I am where I am, but yeah, I suppose that's kind of the headline.
No, thanks Jules, and I think we will talk about change a lot today. I was hosting a HR roundtable yesterday and the HR professionals around the table were unified around how challenging it is at the moment to manage so much change internally and externally. And these were companies from all different industries, from different countries, from different backgrounds, but they all reflected that since the pandemic, there's been a lot of change in their organizations to deal with. But we'll come back to that, Jules, because before we do that, I want to ask, what makes you happy?
Oh, God. So, you know, I like so many things. But I suppose when you ask that question, the thing that really sort of springs to mind, the picture that comes, you know, the picture in front of me is one of being outdoors. You know, for me, it's the absolute joy and pleasure of connection, fundamentally, whether that's connecting with nature, whether it's connecting with people, ideally, both of them. And I often, you know, I have those moments when I'm out there and I suppose I'm a massive lover of the mountains, of getting to remote places and just seeing, you know, the beauty and the beauty and the simplicity in that beauty. And I suppose along with that is, you know, that kind of, you know, no matter what's going wrong in your life or how challenging the day might be, you know, there's nothing better than getting outdoors, doing some physical activity, getting in some great company. And, you know, I don't need stuff. You know, for me, that's what makes me happy. It's like experiences. It's being with people. It's enjoying, you know, the really simple stuff. Sometimes it's often like a backpack and a tent, some very basic food, and just getting out there. That kind of sums it up for me.
Yeah, I love it, Jules. Very, very similar to me on that. Jules, we've spoken about your career. You've worked at some really iconic places, but please tell us about your career to your to our listeners, please.
Oh, like, you know, the thing about my career is I suppose it. I never imagined that I would be doing what I'm doing now. That you know, I very much started off, you know, my very early days, I was going to be an artist. That was my starting point. And that didn't quite work for me because I found myself at art college, basically, really struggling to connect with the sort of, I couldn't see the meaning in the work I was doing. My head was just in like how can I make something look great so it sells? And so I just thought, I don't know what I'm going to do with all of this, because I found the environment very challenging. So unfortunately, I came across design. So I was introduced to that kind of creative thing, but with the element of creativity, but creativity plus commerciality. So I went down that route. So it took me down a path where my initial job was actually as a designer, but part of a marketing team. So I very quickly found myself heading into the commercial world, and started my corporate career, I suppose, like completely unintentionally. But I've kind of always had this view about my career path that I've never kind of overthought it, if that's even an expression. I'm not really kind of intentionally roadmapped anything. It's always been for me about what have I enjoyed, who have I met, what opportunities have come up, and by and large, just saying yes to opportunities as they've arisen. So kind of that led me then down a path of kind of marketing. I spent quite a long time in buying, sort of heading up commercial trading teams, which was like really exciting. And, you know, at the time I was traveling the world. And then, you know, as my life took a bit of my life stage changed and I had young children, I found that a really challenging job to have, because I was spending an awful lot of time away from home and that wasn't who I wanted to be. So from there, I kind of got my feet back on the ground. Went back into marketing, and I suppose I was working in businesses that were big enough to allow like a lot of movement around the company. But I suppose fortunate in so much as the skills that were valued were the ones where people could really understand what a problem was, figure out what the solution was, and get on and create that change that was needed. So I suppose very quickly I found myself leveraging those kind of skills I developed in the very early days, you know, doing my in design, which is fundamentally all about problem solving, and took that then into the commercial world. So my kind of the skills that I was demonstrating allowed me to move around in a company that valued those skills rather than subject matter expertise. To the point where I actually then ended up like in e-commerce back in the early days. So I got this amazing opportunity.
Where was that, Jules?
I was at Asda at the time, and I spent a big chunk of my career. I'd previously worked for businesses like Magnet and IKEA. I moved to work there.
Is Magnet the freezer company?
Kitchen company. And I suppose my kind of experience in the kitchen industry then led me to IKEA at a time when actually IKEA was kind of fairly new in the UK, and trying to figure out what their operating model was, and the kitchen market was proving particularly challenging. So went there and did quite a lot of work around how do we make their product offering fit the UK market, both from a service perspective and from a product pricing perspective.
I don't know if you remember the advert when IKEA came to the UK. It was like everyone chucking their stuff in a skip, wasn't it?
Chuck out the chintz was the big message. It was a very good friend of mine, actually, who had also left Magnet and gone to IKEA, who developed that whole campaign. And at the time, the UK was very country cottage. Lots of floral designs and prints. And so, you know, IKEA were very pioneering at the time, but along with that kind of pioneering approach to design and selling, of course, because the whole model was self-service, they found that kind of quite challenging and had to make some very early adaptations, like in the kitchen industry. It's like people weren't picking their own kitchens. It was a very different kind of model to the one that was used.
How quickly did IKEA have to adapt then, and how much did they need? Was there a perception we'll just take the same thing and it will work in the UK? Like, how much stuff had to change out of interest? Because that is a fascinating brand to discuss.
Yeah, I think quite a lot actually. So there were obvious things like European pillow sizes were different. So initially when they came into the UK, like European pillows are often like more square. So yeah. The pillowcases in like, and it, you know, and in the kitchen industry particularly, our market at the time was not highly modern. I mean, it's changed a lot since then, obviously, but there was a lot of country pine. IKEA had no country pine in their range. And also their perspective on pricing hierarchies was also very different. So stuff that we saw as being premium in the UK, or vice versa, we saw as being at the bottom end was maybe a premium range type of style in Europe. So there was quite a lot of adaptation, and we had to work, you know, with our kind of, the way IKEA was structured was that it had a Northern European, we were part, the UK is part of the European, Northern European structure. So you'd work with the Northern European team to put in place, you know, or I suppose to request what was needed for your specific market. So, and there was quite a lot of freedom to do that, you know, from a product ranging point of view, from a pricing point of view. And I suppose one of the biggest things, particularly in the kitchen industry, was in Europe, they were operating with a kind of a self-design model and providing customers with the tools to self-design. Whereas
we're not ready for that, are we?
No, that was very alien. I still think it is, actually. So yeah. On the back of that, that was all about establishing a kitchen design service. It was all about moving from a sort of a self, there was no, the UK market just wasn't ready for self-serve kitchens, and they don't really do that now. It's like go and pick it yourself. That was like a really alien thing.
That's
in the UK at the time,
because we have that with the Happiness Index platform. You can use our surveys, but you can also design your own surveys. And some people love that, and that is needed in certain territories and places, but some people don't. They want to use our sort of like the gold standard cultural assessment survey and send that out, which means you can benchmark and so on. But you're right, like to some people, when they see that, they're never going to use it. But some people are like, oh great, that's fine, I'll design my own surveys here. And there's so many similarities in terms of adaptation on we talked about product. What about people? Did IKEA have to adapt their approach to leading people in the UK?
Well, you know, actually, what I thought was amazing when I first joined that company was the fact that, firstly, at the time, their principles were really around growing, developing people internally. So typically, anyone that worked in the head office had come through, had a store career. So they'd worked with the company for a while. They understood the company. They fit with the culture. And so what was, I mean, I suppose at the time I was one of the few people, because of their need to bring in some industry specific expertise. That was really about saying, actually, how do we bring somebody in from another company that hasn't lived our culture? For however long. Anyway, so the first part of my journey with them was 2 months working in a store. So I kind of took myself up to Gateshead and stayed in a B&B and literally spent 2 months working around every single department in the store. And as you know, they're pretty big stores. I think I must have lost about a stone in weight with it over that 2 month period, just from the amount of physical activity I was doing.
Yeah, they're huge.
And sort of getting behind the scenes as well. So, you know, the job involved, you know, working in the customer restaurant, in the colleague restaurant. I thought that was brilliant. I think I thought it was a really great introduction. But I thought, you know, the culture was incredible. You know, they were really highly values driven, highly respectful. And, you know, I mean, I loved it. I mean, in all fairness, the only reason I really left was that the job was based in London. And as somebody who's massively into outdoor pursuits, that was quite challenging. I found myself spending a lot of time leaving London and a lot of time trying to get back into it. And at the time I was in a relationship with my now husband. So he made it pretty clear. We have similar kind of shared interests. He made it fairly clear at the time that he wasn't moving to London. So our challenge was how did we then kind of make that work? So it was geography. And it was geography really that took me to Asda. not specifically that I had any intention or plan to go to Leeds, but that was the opportunity that came up. It sounded like an exciting one. So we both took ourselves up to Yorkshire.
So fascinatingly, maybe for some, maybe for not, Jules and I worked at Asda at the same time.
We did.
I was working on the cigarette counter as a student in Canterbury. Jules, just on culture of Asda. Oh, by the way, my local IKEA is now a nightclub. It's that massive one in North London on the 406. It's now become a nightclub that people go to. But that's a story. That's a story for another day.
Wow.
Jules, what was the culture like moving from IKEA to Asda? Similar, different, worlds apart?
Yeah, do you know, what I loved about Asda, and I recall it very clearly from the day I first joined, was total trust and respect. And, you know, I remember sitting down with my first boss at Asda and saying, right, what do I need to do? It's like, well, that's for you to, you know, define.
Yeah.
And whilst that's not right for everyone, and that worked really well for me. I love the fact that actually, you know, get into the business, start talking to people. I mean, clearly I knew what I was going there to do. I had an idea. Yeah. It wasn't like just go and do whatever you do. But, you know, the role was a marketing role. I was really clear what part of the business I was working in, what we were trying to achieve. But then it was really for me to figure out what were the priorities within that. So it was about, you know, getting out there, talking to people, understanding the challenges, getting to know the people, and then coming up with my own roadmap. So,
yeah.
You know, and it was, I thought, you know, Asda worked really hard on culture, on values, on being a great place to work. And for any business, I think that's a challenge to maintain that kind of consistently. Yeah. In every single part of the business all the time. But by and large, I think the intentions were, you know, 100% focused in the right place. It was a really positive place to work with some amazing role models. And of course, you know, over that period of time, there was an awful lot of change as well. So I was fortunate enough to be there long enough to see it being sold to Walmart, see the introduction of Walmart. And of course, now, ironically, kind of many years later, that's all being unraveled. You know, all those integrations and ways of working are now being unraveled to create the kind of, you know, I suppose the next stage. Future for Asda.
There's some interesting parallels there, isn't there, around the design your own kitchen versus this is the kitchen, and also arriving at Asda and it's design your own role, which we know in our data, one of the top drivers of engagement is clarity. So job descriptions are really important for people. But what's fascinating there is there was an open brief with it, which for some people would actually hate, but for you and your personality type, it obviously seemed to work. One thing that we talked about in the Walmart training, because that's when we were both there, I think in the Walmart era, that we spoke about off air, is for those that have never been trained at Asda, is something that if you go into another supermarket can annoy you, because when you're trained at Asda, if someone asks you for a product, you can't leave the customer until you found the product. So if you haven't been trained in that way and you go, for example, into Sainsbury's and you say, where's the jam? And they just point over there and send you off. It can really frustrate you. But I had someone on the podcast once said, I finally understood employee experience when I realized that I need to treat my employees like I do my best customers. And that is one thing that I learned really through the Walmart system, is how to treat customers. But also one of our podcasts made that leap, the second leap, which is, okay, if you're treating your best customers that way, that's the same way you should be treating your employees. So let's go forward to another iconic brand then. Let's just, the Co-op. What's it like going from Asda to the Co-op? The Co-op's quite an iconic brand. What was the culture like there?
Yeah, do you know, again, I suppose I've been fortunate to work for some incredible businesses. And, you know, for sure, the Co-op is another one of them. You know, for a start, you can't fail to be impressed by the incredible building that's just on the outskirts of the city centre.
I don't even know about this. Where is it? What is it?
It's just on the outskirts of Manchester, not far from, it's not Piccadilly, it's Victoria train station. So, it's a super easy commute, a 10-minute walk from the train station, but there's just amazing glazed building, effectively one of Europe's biggest eco buildings.
Right.
And when you go in, it's just like 14, 15, 16 floors high, but open in the middle, so all the offices and meeting rooms around the outside, with lift shafts in three different places, but very light, very bright, very airy, very spacious. I imagine even more spacious now with the whole remote working thing. I mean, this is all pre-remote working, so I can't imagine what some of these places must feel like since the pandemic, because I haven't been in them. But what I found really interesting was, I think when you're in an organization like Asda that's full of highly talented people, and there were a lot of, it's easy actually to feel like at times mediocre, you know, it's like, and actually what was really great for me personally was actually being able to bring my expertise of working in a brand like Asda and all the experience I'd gained into a business that was, you know, possibly a kind of a different stage in its development, in so much as I suppose I'd gone in specifically to support with a piece of change and transformation work.
Yeah.
I suppose I very much felt that even in big organizations, or seemingly big organizations, there's still an awful lot, you know, actually feel you're unsure when you join the organization what you're actually going to be able to bring. But actually, yeah, I realized, God, I've just had such incredible privileges over the previous 17 years that when I actually walked in the door, I thought, you know, there's so much I can bring to this business. And actually, the business was really open and really appreciative of the contributions that people made. You know, I mean, I loved working there. At the time, what we were doing was really working on redefining the membership proposition. So, you know, one of the things that's particularly unique about the co-op is the fact that it's a membership organization, and it's owned by its members. And the importance that they attach to that in terms of how do we actually make sure that we are listening. I suppose in some respects it's not that dissimilar to being a customer-led organization, but it's about how do we absolutely make sure that our business is led and driven by the needs of the members of our business, and the members effectively being the cardholders. You know, it's easy to see it as a loyalty proposition, but I think the bit that they're working on really is how do we make it feel more than that, so people feel that they're shopping means more than just kind of a loyalty scheme.
Yeah, I love that. So Jules, there's even more brands that we don't even have time to go through. Holland & Barra, Santander, so we're not going to go for all of them today. But what's led you to, with all these experience of all these working in these all these different cultures and iconic brands, why do you care about improving the world of work? Like, why does it even matter to you? Because presumably with a CV like this, you could, I'm trying to think of a brand off the top of my head, but you could go and get some great jobs out there, right? I'm sure of it. But why are you on this sort of like mission to improve the world of work? Why is that important to you?
I suppose, like, it, you know, it's easy to paint the world of work as having been, you know, you work for great brands, and it's easy to sort of look at it through rose-tinted glasses. But I think, you know, the reality of any work environment, particularly where you've got very challenging commercial goals and targets, is that those environments don't always bring out the best in people. And those environments don't always prepare and equip the people inside those organizations to be able to do those jobs effectively. And whilst you know, even in businesses that are highly culture driven, it doesn't mean to say that it isn't challenging to be a leader and do the right thing, or to be led by people who aren't always doing the right thing. And so I suppose, you know, there were more than enough occasions where, because of those pressures, you know, I found myself finding it difficult to enjoy what I was doing. And I suppose my own thoughts on it was really around the fact that I really enjoyed the work, you know, that challenge of understanding the problem, creating the solution, and the kind of excitement that I felt when I got to bring a whole load of people together with the sole purpose of solving that problem and creating a solution for, you know, better solution for customers or for employees or whatever. And it's hard enough, all of that, but then you layer onto it, you know, some of the stuff that comes out when people are under pressure, or extreme pressure. And I suppose those were the bits of it. It was never really the getting the job done bit. It was always that kind of tension, I suppose, between doing the work and being part of the environment, the stressful, tough, challenging environment that didn't always lead to behaviours that were as conducive as they could be. And whether that's through, you know, actually saying, look, you know, it doesn't matter what we set, you know, what we stand for as a company, we've got the essence of a great culture here, or a really great culture, but you could see very clearly where there are instances of people who, you know, maybe they were really high achievers, they got the job done, and so actually it was kind of okay to allow behaviors to maybe not quite fit with what we're hoping to, planning to achieve. And the, you know, I suppose the knock-on effects on all of it, whereas, you know, I'm not gonna lie, there were times where the environment made me feel miserable. And I suppose, you know, as I moved around from one company to another, I kind of ended up seeing the same things, you know, and I genuinely think, you know, most people, you know, they're decent people, but environments can often shape the way people react and respond. And a lot of that is driven through either self-preservation, through fear, whether it's fear of loss, fear of losing face, fear of losing a job, fear of not being seen as being up to it, you know, all that sort of stuff sort of drives unhelpful behaviors. And so, you know, I genuinely ended up feeling like we can do better than this, you know. I've been through all the training I'm getting isn't adequate, and it's the wrong time. I didn't feel the training was right. I didn't know what the answer was. Don't get me wrong. It's, you know, taken a bit of a while for me to kind of figure that out. But I genuinely just feel work's tough enough. Too many people are miserable at work. I had my own period of being miserable at work, and I actually felt, do you know, we need to change this. And we need to change it at scale and quickly.
How do you do that?
Well, you know, therein lies the million-dollar question, isn't it? So, you know, first and foremost, for me, it was about trying to identify what I felt the problem was. I suppose I'd bucket it in a number of ways. One is that I felt that the training wasn't necessarily the right training. There was a lot of, you know, theory, not a lot of practical application. Like, what do I actually go away and do? I often felt that it was too little and too late. So we don't really lay the foundations really effectively. And I think this is quite a big one for me, in that I think there's levels of leadership before you even get to becoming a leader of other people, like directly, like that line management responsibility. And it starts with level one, which is like self-leadership. How do I lead myself? How do I understand who I am, the way, and you know, the unintentional behaviors I have that have adverse impacts on others. So there's level one. Level two for me is all about getting the best out of others. So yeah. How do I start to understand and value people that maybe think differently to me, bring something different to me, don't do things the way I do. Yeah. And then you know, I mean, to be honest, the problem goes back. I think we need to be tackling it a lot earlier than the workplace, if I'm honest. That's probably a conversation for another day as well. But I think these problems start at school, where you get dominant characters, you get people that start taking a back seat, they feel a fear of speaking up or saying what they need to say or want to say or make their contribution. I think it starts really early. But the problem is it then starts to manifest itself in the workplace, where, you know, ultimately we still end up with a challenge whereby, you know, leadership is still kind of how would I describe it, is, you know, there's a lot of challenge around leaders who are, you know, dominant leaders with a particular leadership style. It's almost like the stereotypical view of leadership. Yeah. So I'm not saying that. So I think there's a lot of remodeling that we need to do in terms of our approach. How do you do it at pace and at scale? That there in itself, I think it needs an army of people. You know, I'm trying to do my bit, but I think there's an awful lot of collaboration that people within the industry can do to actually say, look, you know, we need to. For me, for example, the emphasis is on, how do you create measurable outcomes? So one of the things that stops businesses investing is the fact that it's all often seen as being a bit fluffy.
Yeah.
We invest a load of money. We don't really know what we get as a result of it. So, you know, how do we turn that on its head as well? How do we create business? How do we create accountability?
Yeah, we do that now when we onboard new clients with the Happiness Index, because obviously happiness is something, although we know is incredibly serious, can be deemed as fluffy. So part of the new onboarding process is clarifying exactly what outcomes they are, where they currently sit. Retention is an example. Employee retention, where is it is now? What is the retention rate now, so we can measure it over time, and all these other factors. But once you start getting those metrics in there, that's where success happens. Jules, I can't believe it. We've only got 5 minutes left, so we're gonna have to we're gonna have to go into quick fire mode, because there's a few questions I want to get out. I'm gonna have to give you a minute on each answer. What data research would you like to share? We always have a data section on here. Anything that you're interested in at the moment that you've been reading or seen?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of bits. I mean, obviously, I've alluded to the fact that data is kind of important to me in the work that I do. And there's two bits. So one of the things, I work in partnership with a company called Giant Worldwide, and we do a lot of personality profiling, team performance assessments. So I've gathered over the years, like, the data on the back of having worked with, you know, thousands of businesses and leaders. And there's a couple of things actually that that kind of led me towards partnering with them. And effectively, one of them is that there's a statistic that was like quite eye-opening to me as someone who'd been a leader, and that is that 82% of people in the workplace feel unseen, unheard, and misunderstood. And when I started really dive into that, understanding that there are particular personality types that dominate and others that sit back and don't bring their best. And when I started to really unpick that, because obviously I've dived really deep into the work that Giant have done, Five Voices as a personality profiling mechanism. And it pretty much for me uncovered every single mistake I ever made as a leader, because and probably got in the way of me. And I felt like I was always trying to do my best for my people, but I never understood personality. And I never understood the people that didn't speak up in a room. I never understood the people that were really annoying with all their questions. And actually, if I'd have been able to unpick that and understand it better, I think I'd have got so much more out of people that I've worked with over the years. So
that's fascinating. I think the people who ask the questions, that is something that leaders have to get on board with and understand, because I speak to a lot of leaders, they get annoyed if they present something and then a load of questions come in. But that's just people wanting clarity so they can do their job. It's a good thing if people are asking questions. So, okay, thank you for sharing that. That's that about being feeling unseen and unheard is incredibly sad, but also from a business performance perspective, if you've got people feeling like that, it has to be fixed. I've got a one-on-one after this. I'm actually going to ask that person how they would score that. Let's see what they say.
Well, it's interesting because there's one thing I wanted to add, because what it leads to then is the other one piece of data is that the average team performs at less than 60% of its potential.
Not surprised.
So when 100% is possible, so every team has the ability to perform to 100% of its potential. And actually the challenge is then, how do you unpick that? And that's where the data comes in for me, is when you understand that, you know the work that needs to be done, you do the right work, you put in place the measures give you accountability, and you start getting the outcomes that you're looking for.
And most people know the answers already. Asking your team, what do you need to be operating at 100%? You might be able to fix it all, but you might be able to get them to 85-90%. So if you're moving that dial, that's amazing. So last two quick questions. So creating the elusive, as you call it, measurement and accountability culture. Can you summarize that for us in 60 seconds? How do you create a measurement and accountable culture?
So for me, so in the work that I do, it's about saying, right, you know, we're using a high performing teams framework. We understand what, you know, it's more than proven what drives high performance. So when we do well in five areas, communication, relationships, alignment, execution and capacity, when we understand where we are against that, we know the work we need to do. We do the work. We measure if we're making progress against that. And we focus on the right things first, right? So communication and relationships is what builds trust. And without all of that, it's really hard to get alignment and execution. So when you think about the approach a lot of businesses take, it's like, what do we need to do? Have we done it? But actually the big gap in a lot of it is when you start to build communication, you start to build relationships, you start to build trust, then even without focusing on the other stuff, you can see the data start to move. And so for me, it is about like just having something that you're shooting for and being able to wrap a bit of data around it, say, how are we doing? Are we making progress? And of course, when you have that data, you can create that bit of accountability. Ultimately, you don't want it being top down, you know, how it pressure on people. It should be about owning it individually. It's to say, I've got the tools and the mechanisms to understand where I am with my team. I buy into the direction that we need to go in, and we're doing the work to get there, and that it's owned by the team. I mean, that's ultimately where you want to get to, rather than it being like, you know, top down. You need to do this.
No, I love that. I love that, Jules. So we're on to the last question. So I'll try and summarize. It's been amazing to hear about your career and the journey, and I love how you've taken all the positive parts of it and apply it in what you do now, but also you don't shy away from the negative bits and the cultures and the toxicity you've seen, but you've now turned it into a positive piece by using data and accountability. So I love that, Jules. If we could go in a time machine to meet 18-year-old Jules, what is the one bit of advice you would give for that Jules, or someone now starting out in their career?
One of the things that I think has probably been most challenging in my career is just that kind of never really realizing I don't have to work for shitty bosses. You know, it's like, you know, I think you can spend too much time. I think your happiness is important, you know, back on the theme of why we're here is I think we both, you know, more than buy into the fact that happy people do their best work. Yeah. And actually it's, I mean, thankfully, I do think times have changed. Yeah. You know, I think the pandemic's brought a load of challenges, of course, but it's also brought a load of positives, in so much that I do think it's easy for people to not have to stay working somewhere that they're not necessarily enjoying. Because before you know it, you can end up with 2, 3, 4, 5 years or even more of a period of time in your life where you're not enjoying what you're doing and you feel stuck. And I think it's easier not to feel stuck and to move because of the whole kind of hybrid thing. And the thing is, it's like we all know that the way we feel about our work and our jobs is not just about how we do in our jobs and how we perform. It's about, you know, we take all that stuff. It impacts more than work. It impacts relationships. It impacts our connection with our kids. It impacts our social lives. It impacts our physical health. And so, and for sure, there were times where I would say, I mean, I certainly saw people crushed by some of the environments and microcultures, I suppose, that they, and I call them microcultures because I think we've talked generally about companies that have amazing cultures, but where microcultures exist and they make people unwell. And the consequences of that are way more far reaching than the workplace. And it's worse, it costs lives, right? Because people attach so much of their value to their jobs and their careers. And so, you know, I would say to my kids and anyone starting out that it is just not worth it. It's not worth your health. And you know, I mean, of course, it's not always practical. You know, sometimes we aren't happy, and you just got to figure out, but proactively kind of figure out, how do I move away from this? It's, you know, I think your happiness is worth way more than any job, any relationship, any, you know, it's like, if you're not happy, then fundamentally every single aspect of your life is affected. So hopefully that ties nicely back to the theme of you know, why we're here. Is just like, you know, life's short, and you know, before you know it, you can get sucked into periods of it where you're just not enjoying what you're doing. And it's, you know, for me, actually, with the benefit of hindsight, it's just not worth it.
Jules, we're at, time is up, so I'm gonna have to say sum up by saying you've been a wonderful guest. It's been fascinating to hear about your career and what you've learned, and I love the advice at the end. And as you say, it's not always practical, but at least you can start putting a plan to move towards happiness. So thank you, Jules. I will finish by saying a huge thank you for our listeners as well, because they will have learned loads as well today, Jules. So thank you, and we hope to hear from you soon.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Matt.